Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
It is currently 7:14. President Trump weighing in on the crash that happened over the Potomac, and we'll talk more about that in a second with an expert on this. But he's saying that I think, and I'm trying to not be political here, but he is the president, and he did put this out on social media that says the airplane was on a perfect and routine line of approach to the airport. The helicopter was going straight at the airplane for an extended period of time. It is a clear night, he puts in all caps. The lights on the plane were blazing. Why didn't the helicopter go up or down or turn? Why didn't the control tower tell the helicopter what to do instead of asking if they saw the plane? This is a bad situation. It looks like it should have been prevented, not good. Yeah, again, that's the president of the United States, and what he says matters. I think it's a little bit early to reach those kind of conclusions. And with that in mind, Steve Green joins us, author at Airfax Journal. He's a Captain Steve Green, a retired pilot, experienced accident investigator, and has experience with Reagan Airport as well. Good morning, Captain Steve. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. So did you graduate from Louisiana Tech or not? Did I see that right?
I did, actually. I was there the last year, to be fair. I didn't go all 4 years.
But my kid lives in Ruston, and it amazed me what a beautiful area that is. So let's talk about the crash. I'm not trying to get political here, but the words that the president either tweets or says do matter, because he's the president of the United States. Is it a little bit early to be jumping to conclusions here or not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've got an awful lot of work ahead of us to determine exactly what was going on. It seems to me from what I'm reading that the helicopter had or thought they had the jet in sight, and clearly they did not. I think that's one statement we can make. Why that is, that's a long ways out yet. We don't know all of the particulars at all.
I went to D.C. Recently, and we flew into Dulles, and I should have known this, but I didn't. At Dulles, about a 45-minute ride from where the airport is, I guess, in Virginia, technically, all the way to Washington, D.C. Reagan, not the case. That's right in the heart of D.C., and I would presume that's some of the most tightly controlled airspace in the world?
Yeah, it is. It's a very busy place because, to begin with, you have a restricted area straight north of the airport because of the White House. They really prefer that you don't fly over that. And then you've got a lot of military traffic with Andrews Air Force Base out to the east and Fort Belvoir, where this particular helicopter, I gather, was based, is just down to the south of Mount Vernon slightly. So there's an awful lot of traffic. There's always been helicopter traffic out there. They have some reasonably well-defined routes that they are supposed to be on, but it's still a very tight airspace. And when you add in things like nighttime, it was a pretty gusty night, a lot of wind. I don't know what role that may have had, but there's a whole bunch of things that have to be taken into consideration.
When it comes to Reagan itself, the airport itself, how difficult is it to fly into and out of it, as opposed to, say, a Dulles or other airports?
I wouldn't say it's difficult really at all. I think the biggest limitation with Reagan is simply that the runways aren't very long. And the runway this aircraft was lining up with is really just 5,200 feet, which is perfectly acceptable, but you really want to make sure everything is just right. So it can be fairly busy making the maneuver because it does require you to circle out to the east, up the east shore of the Potomac, and then turns line up with that shorter runway, on a gusty night, they're going to be pretty busy.
I'm going to try to play this audio, if I can, that's online from the air traffic controllers, and it just gives an indication of what kind of, I guess, what kind of communication happens between the air traffic controllers and the aircraft. I guess what is important here is this needs to be, people need to realize, I guess, what I'm trying to say, Captain, that this is happening in real time. It's kind of like calling a football game, but a lot more serious than that because lives are at stake. So the air traffic controller has to both analyze what's going on and then quickly determine what each aircraft has to do. And from that point, they have to advise the different pilots what they should do, right?
Yeah. It's their ability to have a three-dimensional picture in their head is unparalleled. And I've always been in awe of their ability to do that job. It's just amazing.
Let me see if I can play a little bit of this. This is audio. It's going to take about 30 seconds if y'all can listen closely. Tim, you're going to have to turn this way up loud because the volume's low.
342 at the Wilson Bridge, change and start for runway 33, runway 33, clear to land. 25 Memorial. S25 right. S25, get the CRJ in flight. S25, pathfind the CRJ.
S25 has an aircraft in sight, Christmas separation.
And then the collision happens, and the air traffic controls.
American 3130, go around turn left in 250, climb Anthony 3000.
Respond to it. Just for people that heard that, that's in real time. And to second guess and say this should have been done or that should have been done, these are instantaneous. And just, I guess I'm trying to ask you to do, Captain, when we come back, take us into the cockpit and explain in real time how you have seconds to everybody has seconds to react to this. The air traffic controllers, the people piloting the plane, which do not have brakes, by the way, and the people piloting the helicopter. We'll talk more when we come back. Lucky to have with us, who is available on short notice, Captain Tyler Anderson. He is a former pilot, has experienced flying in the Reagan, and an experienced accident investigator as well. Unfortunately, any loss of life is sad, but particularly tragic. A news team caught up with a guy sitting in the airport whose wife was on the plane, and he texted, and her was texting back and forth, didn't get anything back, and then he just said he hoped they could find her, and they're not talking about any survivors at all. So we'll talk about the investigation when we come back. 721 Traffic Now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Captain Steve Green. Captain, my apologies. I called you Tyler Anderson, who is an aircraft enthusiast and an orthopedic surgeon that posted that audio online. That's where I got that, so my apologies for that.
And that's all right.
We're talking about the collision midair Black Hawk helicopter and a it was a commercial flight, but it was a commuter airline, right? Is there a big difference when it comes to experience and the pilots? And I'm not assigning blame to anybody in any way. I'm just wondering about the nuts and bolts of this. How do you go about, I guess maybe the more pertinent question would be, how do you even begin an investigation like this?
Oh, goodness. Well, the investigation starts with what's known as the field phase, which is what they're starting right now. Where they convene a number of people with expertise from the NTSB, supporting parties, obviously the FAA, everybody's there. There's the wreckage recovery, identification of victims, and all of this sort of thing. But they'll spend a good week to 10 days documenting everything there is to know about this. Air traffic control recordings, radar data, the wreckage itself, obviously the recorders, cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder. In the jet, and I'm assuming that the helicopter has something very similar. So it'll be a pretty intense period while they do all this documentation. Then they're going to go back and start to sort it out, and that's going to take probably a number of months.
When it comes to traffic collision avoidance systems, do all commercial airliners have those, regardless of the size, and what is that?
Oh, they do. And it is a, this is obviously going to become quite a topic with this event. It's been mandated. They've all been equipped for many, many years. The TCAS, threat collision avoidance system arose out of the San Diego accident back in 1978, the PSA Airlines accident. And it really is an invaluable tool in terms of traffic awareness and separation. I don't know exactly what the military status is on that. I don't know that all military aircraft are that equipped. So I don't really want to go out and comment on that. But the civilian airplane, the passenger jet, certainly had that equipment.
So what would that? What would the pilot have? And at what point, if everything was working? Look, you don't know what was going on with that aircraft. I realize that, Captain. But typically, what would a commercial pilot? What would that TEC? How did you say it? TCAS. What would that do in the cockpit? What would you hear? What would you see? And at what point would it go off?
When it detects that there is a collision threat, it will provide guidance to resolve that threat, some kind of climb, turn, something of that nature. Typically, it's just a climb and altitude change. But it has to have information from both aircraft. Mm-hmm. So if one of the aircraft is not providing all of that information, then it will show the conflicting traffic as a symbol on a visual display in the cockpit, but it may not be able to determine that there's actually a collision threat. So
would it trigger the TCAS to go off, or would it just show up as an object? And what you're saying is there has to be a sender from one aircraft and a receiver in the other, and vice versa, right?
Exactly. Okay. And if for whatever reason that's not happening, then it may show a symbol that says, you know, there's traffic there, but it may not have any altitude information or anything like that. So at that stage in their approach, the jet crew simply may not have noticed that, depending on what was displayed and so forth. That's the kind of stuff that we got to get out of the investigation.
When it comes to that TCAS and air traffic control, would that have gone off before the air traffic controller would have been able to say anything, if everything was working ideally?
Yeah, ideally, it should have. Normally, what you get, if everything's working properly, is you'll get a warning that there's a potential threat, and then you'll get ultimately a command and flight guidance in the cockpit on how to take evasive action. So, you know, the idea is you got to follow that guidance.
So many things,
even if you don't see the traffic.
So many people are trying to make this political already. And again, it's so early. Nobody even knows what happened yet or begins to know what happened. When it comes to air traffic controllers, are the towers in the country properly staffed, accurately staffed, staffed?
I think it's hard for me to make that judgment. They do an incredible job. I mean, they are, I think, probably some of the most unsung heroes in the whole industry because of the job that they do. And if you look at the number of the volume of traffic they're dealing with and so forth, they really do an amazing job. I don't know whether they have all the people that they want, and I don't know what the rotations are or the number of retirements and all of these kinds of things that factor into it. So yeah, they're doing an amazing job, but it's something that we really need to pay close attention to and you know, listen to what they're saying, because they really it's just remarkably stressful.
I can't even.
I have a lot of admiration for them.
Can't imagine, Captain. I hope we can have you back as the investigation moves on. Captain Steve Green, thank you, sir. Was available on short notice. He is an experienced pilot. He investigates accidents, and he's got experience with Reagan. Very insightful. Time now for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. Thank you, Dave. 7:40, 20 till 8, Super Bowl coming, of course, and I can use that phrase instead of the big game because Scott Vaughn joins us now, the founder of Unbranded. He was an SEC official. His dad was an NFL official, and not only the NFL officials, but the NFL have sanctioned a Super Bowl ticket giveaway that Scott is having for Unbranded. Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good, Tommy. How about you?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me about the giveaway first, and we'll talk about the organization Unbranded.
All right. Well, the National Football League Referee Association has provided Unbranded with 10 Super Bowl tickets to the game in New Orleans, of course, this year, just in, what, I guess, a little over a week now. Mm-hmm. And we're doing a raffle that for $200, and it's a, you know, we're a 501c3, so your donation is 100% tax deductible. But for $200, you get a raffle ticket and a chance to win a pair of Super Bowl 59 game tickets that are valued at $7,500 just for two tickets to the big game. And the proceeds we're using to purchase a portable laser so that basically we can go mobile. You know, we can go all over the state of Louisiana and treat these survivors of sex trafficking at the different organizations that are helping them with all their other healthcare issues right now.
Real quick, tell me about the tattoos that people that are sex trafficked have and how it's similar to, like, a UBC, you, what is it, UPC code you'll see on a product? In the
well, a barcode. Yeah.
Barcode, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So some of them are. You know, a sex trafficker will brand a boy or a girl that claims ownership over a human being. It's no different than a rancher brands his livestock. And they do that so, you know, let's say that boy or girl escapes their control, then that lets other sex traffickers know who that boy or girl belongs to. So it's basically claiming ownership of a human being. And a lot of times a sex trafficker will sell a boy or a girl to another sex trafficker, and then that sex trafficker puts his brand or logo on that boy or girl to claim ownership. So, you know, these boys and girls end up with multiple tattoos. The ones that I treat do have multiple tattoos, and we remove them. You know, it's critical in the healing process because no matter how many times a sex trafficking survivor goes to a psychiatrist to get help, as soon as they get home and look in the mirror and they have that constant reminder slapping them in the face of the physical, mental, and sexual pain that they've endured for so many years, you know, it's just so important and critical. And that's where we come in. You know, we help with that healing process.
Scott, when's the drawing?
The drawing's tonight at 7 o'clock live on Facebook at unbranded.org. And, you know, throughout the day, I hope that we get some phone calls and some people interested, but they can go to our homepage at unbranded.org, and all the information is right there so that they can donate for a raffle ticket. And if you donate $1,000, you'll get 6 raffle tickets instead of 5. And I will immediately scan the raffle ticket and email it right back to the donor.
And you're only selling 1,500, correct?
1,500, that's correct.
All right, so that's the drawings tonight, go to unbranded.org if you can. These are from the NFL and the NFL officials, so I presume they're pretty good seats.
They are. They're very good seats. They're kind of in that club level, right in that middle.
Outstanding. Thank you, Scott. Good cause, good organization. Ms. Gail Benson's involved. The NFL's involved, as legit can get. And an ugly side of life that you're doing something to make better. Thank you, sir. Go to unbranded.org. Get
Thank
your
you.
Super Bowl, you bet, raffle tickets if you can. Man, pull out a grand. Get yourself 6 tickets and watch a drawing tonight. 7:43, we'll take a break. Come back, talk to Jacques Thibodeau, director of GoSep, about Super Bowl plan security and after-action report on a Bourbon Street attack. Busy morning, 7:48, 12 till 8, Tommy Tucker. Quickly to Colonel Jacques Thibodeau, director of the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. Tell me, good morning, Colonel, how are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How's it going today?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me about the after-action report as it relates to the Bourbon Street attack and how that applies to the plan the governor announced yesterday for the Super Bowl.
Well, first off, this is different than pretty much any other AAR that I've ever been a part of. And the reason why is to get an after-action review after an event in 28 days published is very rare. Now, the reason why it happened in this circumstance is we're on a compressed timeline, and we needed to use this after-action review to shape our preparation for the Super Bowl. So to kind of take it a step further, when we were going through the process, the governor said, I want the public to be able to see this after-action review. So what that meant to us is yesterday when we briefed the governor in our incident command preparations with Mayor Cantrell in the briefing and our state agencies, when the governor saw the AAR for the first time, we turned it into a public record document and sent it out to all 64 parish OEPs, all state agencies, as well as we put it up on the web for the public to view. So the reason why we have moved forward so fast on a document like this is it is a learning tool for us to move forward into next week for the Super Bowl.
So what changes going on what the governor was talking about yesterday? Expand on that, Colonel, if you will, and what the French Quarter is going to be like next week and for the Super Bowl as opposed to what it's like, I guess, now, or when does that go into effect?
Okay, so what you're going to see is, and you've already started to see it, some of that security equipment is going in place, and then you're going to see a massive amount of what we call force multipliers. First responders in the fire area, the EMS, and in the police area, massive support to the city of New Orleans, in excess of several thousand first responders that are going to be supporting the Super Bowl. So that's the first thing that you see from the overall perspective of the public. Now, from GOSEF's perspective, what we are doing is, just as an example, one of the lessons we learned in the AAR is procedurally our communications, we wanted to refine them. So what you saw in the weather event where we sent out alert notices to cell phones and used LA wallets is a tool that specifically came out of the AAR as to something we can do better. And that will be in play and capable to use for the Super Bowl next week.
So when it comes to, I guess, the secure zone in the French Quarter, you know, this to me goes to, I don't know, how do you control the quarter? Is it just Bourbon Street when it comes to cross streets, et cetera? And where exactly will you be able to enter and leave, and who's going to be searching you?
Absolutely. So what you're going to see is they're called enhanced security zones. And what they do is they mirror what the NFL is doing at the NFL venues. And you're going to see entry control into those locations. What I will tell everyone is if you're looking for information on the security aspects, it's in the governor's executive order. It will be on the GOSEP website. And it also will be on our Get a Game Plan app as we roll into next week on all of those elements. So basically what we're trying to do is balance public safety with the opportunity to have a safe time in an entertainment venue. Our city is a beautiful city, and it is historical, and we want people to know that there is going to be a balance. They will be safe, and we encourage everyone to attend the events of next week.
So it's not going to be the entire quarter. It's going to be select areas of the quarter that are going to be zoned off. Is that accurate?
That's correct. And when you look at the in the executive order, there's actually a map that displays that, and that map basically shows all the routes, the one-way streets. It shows you what the enhanced security zones look like, and again, it mirrors what the NFL is doing at the Superdome and the Convention Center.
Now, for people that are wondering, that's not available yet online, or is it?
It is online. It is online. The executive order is online. As well as we begin the update, the best thing that you will see, you will really begin to see updates next week as we go into our process of preparing for the actual event itself. Our enhanced security elements begin on Monday in support of the city and run all the way through the Super Bowl itself.
So it is going to be analogous to entering the football game, almost, in that you're going to have their limits on. I understand we have it posted on our website at WWL.com, the French Quarter Security Zone. That's all you have to do to see it. Go to WWL.com. But it's going to be similar in that you're going to be limited to the size of what you can carry, and also it either has to be transparent or it's like entering a theme park almost, right? People are going to search what you got on you.
Absolutely, or similar if you're going to the Saints game, right? So basically the bottom line on it is what the policy is that if you want to go into that area and you have a bag and you don't want to be searched, that's certainly within your rights. But it means you will not be allowed to enter in that zone until you are subject to search. So you're going to see, if you're going to a Saints game, it's going to be in these. That's why they're called enhanced security zones, and they're designed basically to keep everyone safe, and it's one of our many mitigation measures we're doing for not only Super Bowl, we will do it again for Mardi Gras.
I don't know why you'd have to bring an ice chest. You can't, but I don't know why you would to the French Quarter anyway, because they got merchants selling stuff there, and I don't know why that should be allowed regardless. Thank you, Colonel. I appreciate your time. Have a good day.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right, the Enhanced Security Zone, you can find it at WWL.com, runs from Canal to St. Ann Street, and then the other way from Dauphine over to Royal Street. And you can find all of that at WWL.com. A lot going on, 7:55, 5 till 8. Traffic now, WWL.